Hello and welcome to another Brain Trust Live Legal Spectacular.
SCOTUS edition.
Hey y'all, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com. We have brought back our resident legal expert, Ben Softness, because as you probably heard in the news, it's the horrifying part of June where all of the Supreme Court decisions come down. And Ben, as a lawyer who's barred at the Supreme Court, who has worked on SCOTUS cases, is going to help us work through some of the the damage that was done in the last week by the Supreme Court. Welcome back, Ben.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks.
Welcome.
Thanks, Brent.
Yeah.
So there are four cases we're going to discuss. Only three of them are absolutely horrifying. But before we get into the horrifying cases, let's briefly discuss Moore v. Harper, the gerrymandering North Carolina elections decision that actually came, I think, a week before a lot of these other decisions, and is less bad news, more medium to good news than really anything else that happened.
Yeah, gave us a little false hope.
That's right.
Yeah, definitely. The Constitution says, and I'm quoting, "The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof," the legislature of each state. To almost everybody, although, you know, the this growing conservative legal movement to sort of overthrow normal elections, that means that the legislatures make the rule, but they make the rules according to like the ordinary rules by which legislatures make rules. So state constitutions create state legislatures, and state laws passed by state legislatures can be examined by state courts to make sure that they're, you know, constitutional and otherwise like passed in accordance with like legislative procedure and all the usual ways that laws get sort of examined. There's been a growing conservative legal movement called the independent state legislature theory, which says because the Constitution refers specifically to state legislatures, instead of saying something like the rules shall be made by the states or state governments, that no state body other than the legislature can even be involved. So if I think that my state has passed a law that, you know, is, you know, discriminatory or something, I can't go challenge it in the state court because only the state legislature can weigh in. It's pretty radical because, like, of course, you know, when we think of federal law, like the U.S. Congress can only do stuff if it's constitutional, if it's something that, you know, and the Supreme Court obviously steps in all the time and reviews stuff that Congress does. So anyway, the court said, no, when we refer to the legislature, we're saying the legislature as it is authorized by its, you know, its foundations, and that it can be reviewed by state courts, and a state legislature can create a state commission to do districting and that kind of stuff. So disaster avoided.
Great.
One disaster avoided.
One disaster avoided. Yeah.
Does that then mean that, you know, North Carolina has had some gerrymandering dramas of late? Does that mean that, are they going to have to redistrict again in North Carolina? Like, what happens now that this decision has come down?
So I think, and I confess, it was quite the procedural mess because the original districting lines were invalidated. And then the Supreme Court in North Carolina basically changed its membership. There was an election to the court, and then that the new court came in and reversed the first court's decision and said, never mind, there was no standing to pursue this challenge. But I think the first court's judgment throwing out the gerrymandered districts stands. And so they still have to draw new districts. But I think, you know, unfortunately, given the more conservative state Supreme Court that swept in North Carolina, you know, I don't have a high degree of confidence that there'll be a ton of protections for, you know, ensuring fair districts, because the current law in North Carolina following that switch is that gerrymandering is not subject to judicial review.
What an exciting opportunity for them to be dramatic once again.
Yeah.
We're never going to stop talking about gerrymandering in North Carolina.
It's one of these, this decision in the Supreme Court is one of these that like makes a good rule, but may not be able to save this particular district cycle.
Okay. So with that behind us, let's talk about the awful decisions that everyone is panicking about in both media and their own minds and in their hearts, because we got three decisions in particular that were fairly disastrous. I was just saying to somebody the other day, I was like, I can't remember when it was that June became like a month of horrors for everyone. It's like, let us enjoy summer. Like, you know, let us have the beginning of summer to frolic and enjoy nice things. And instead it's like every late June, we're like, America's falling apart. Here's how this year. Like, and that is, I think also a bunch of these involve student things. I think it's notable that they always come at the very end of the school year. So it's just like, while you have your free time this summer, panic at how terrible the education system is going to become. But let's talk first about this affirmative action case. I know that that is one that you have done a bunch of reading on. I also know that it's the Supreme Court case with the most long-winded name. And so I feel like it's a good place to start. So this is Students for Fair Admissions Incorporated, the President and Fellows of Harvard College.
Quite a mouthful.
What is this case? What happened here? Tell us what this is.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's just go in right into like the legal question, because this is the part that's, I think, you know, it's such an unfortunate outcome, right? The 14th Amendment to the Constitution. I mean, I'm always going to, I hope this is why you bring me on. I'll go to the actual source of the law.
Yeah,
it is.
The 14th Amendment says,
we certainly were never going to.
I was
going to
say, we could act like blowhards on the internet and rage about this, which is what we do on any other week. So yes, this is why you're here.
No, I want to make it way less entertaining. So it says no state shall enforce any law which denies to any person the equal protection of the law. And for, you know, decades, there's been a big disagreement about whether that, you know, allows or doesn't allow race conscious admissions. Right. And the Supreme Court basically said, no, equal protection of the law means you cannot consider an applicant's race if when deciding. Now, I should go back and say schools take federal funding. And so for purposes of these decisions, you know, any school that takes federal funding is sort of acting as the state and can be regulated by the 14th Amendment. If a school was totally private, it wouldn't be governed by a constitutional provision that says the state shall do something. But anyway, but no, to equal protection means, you know, two applicants of different races have to be treated exactly the same. And historically, you know, the left, the progressives, the Democratic side, the dissent in this case have said, no, equal protection does not mean exactly, you know, exactly the same treatment for everybody. It means, no, it recognizes the fact that because of structural disadvantages going back centuries, that to provide equal protection requires us to be conscious of those discrepancies in order to promise equal protection. That's kind of the debate. It's been going on for a long time. And the Supreme Court said 6-3 that you cannot consider race because that violates the Equal Protection Clause.
You know, you can sort of look at the law, I suppose, however you want to specifically look at it. But I mean, it seems like they've done so, you know, without context of, you know, the 400 years of history in the country, which seems like perhaps a mistake in this instance.
Well, if you're originalist, maybe you don't care about history because everything started at the beginning and nothing has happened since, because you only care about what was originally written 400 years ago. There's no context.
No, I think it really is. I think you're exactly right that it's the majority opinion is like really bereft of context and really just sort of is like this hyper formalist, you know, equal means equal and equal means the same. And therefore, you know, you can't look at someone's race and treat them different, even if that means sort of recognizing historical disparities and, you know, systemic racism, because that itself is racial discrimination. I mean, the Chief Justice, you know, has said long ago in a case, the sort of, I think, overly simplistic formulation he used was, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And I think that sentence well encapsulates like how simple I think the majority thinks this is, and how much context they're missing when they decide that way. I mean, you know, so I totally agree.
Is there, can you talk a little bit, because one of the things that I think has been so alarming about this court and was alarming last year in the Dobbs decision is their willingness to overturn legal precedents that have been established for decades that were also Supreme Court precedents. And this sort of does a similar thing where we've already put affirmative action on trial at the federal level and decided that it is legal. And they are now just like, nope, that's not it anymore. Can you talk a little bit about just sort of like the culture of a court that's just like overturning legal precedents that their own court created? Like, why is this happening right now? What is the, I mean, I guess we all know broadly why, but like, what does this mean in terms, is anything safe from this then? Like, what does this all mean?
Boy, that's a hard question. I mean, honestly, look, I think you're right. When you say we kind of know why, I mean, a big reason why is they have the votes. I think that's like, they have the votes, and it's not even like these are nail biters anymore. It's 6-3. And if you zoom out and you don't see what's happened and you don't remember the Merrick Garland scandal and this night, you think, oh, 6-3. Maybe this was an easy case, right? You know, but you're absolutely right. In the 70s, there was an affirmative action case. I think it was called Backe versus the Regents of the University of California at Berkeley. And it decided that some amount of race conscious admissions was okay, based on the idea that, funny, there's a lot of reasons why race conscious admissions should be okay. But the sort of governing rationale in the Supreme Court has always been that diversity is sort of an educational good. Diversity is good for every student to sort of be exposed to a diverse student body and participate in a diverse student body. In the, you know, I think it was like 20 or 25 years later, two more cases came up to the Supreme Court. And again, you know, some measure of race conscious admissions was all right. In Fisher, a couple of years ago, another case came to the Supreme Court. It went up twice. There was Fisher 1 and Fisher 2. And yeah, I mean, now in none of these cases was there a position that commanded all, like a 5-justice majority. There were basically like a scattered array of opinions with, you know, I'm not going to get the numbers exactly right, but 2 justices would have said any amount of race conscious admissions is okay. 3 would have said none. And then there were, you know, 3 or 4 more in the middle. We each thought something, and whoever was kind of, you know, who had the most number of votes total, like the least, you know, the position that has like, is, can get the most number of people is the one that sort of governs until it comes up again. And I think this majority would say, well, look, there was never really a consensus on the court. This always splintered the court. And now we've sort of realized why. It's because this isn't really workable in practice. But I think, Lila, like, they didn't say a lot of that. They didn't say even, you know, at least in Dobbs, which, you know, obviously overturned Roe and was, did so, I think, a little casually. At least they said, we're overturning Roe, and here all the, you know, we have these factors we consider when we overturn precedent. And this decision really didn't do that, didn't sort of acknowledge that it was overturning Grutter versus Bollinger and Backe and Fisher and all these cases that have been saying race conscious admissions is okay to some extent for a long time. So I think it's definitely concerning in that regard too.
Yeah, it does feel very brazen. Can you talk a little bit about what the dissent said or argued? Because I also feel like there was a lot of discussion, at least that I saw, about sort of how the dissent had framed this, in part because it was casually overturning legal precedent. But what did they sort of say in the dissent?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of good points in the dissent. There were 2 dissents. Justice Sotomayor wrote a dissent kind of focused on more like strictly legal arguments. And then Justice Jackson wrote a dissent focusing on some of the harmful impact of the decision. But I think it was really interesting because, you know, I mean, interesting and obviously like gutting in a way, like there are legal arguments. You don't have to just think, oh, this is awful. And, you know, the policy outcome is so terrible. There's also a lot of legal arguments for the dissent that make me think that the majority overlooked. I mean, for example, even if you wanted to be sort of a strictly originalist, and what did these words mean when they were adopted? And we usually think of originalism as being this conservative leaning doctrine, right? But like, let's just parse the words. Equal protection. The law. It doesn't say equal treatment. It says equal protection. And if you have one group that's already pretty well protected and another group that's been enslaved and harshly discriminated against for centuries, it might take different treatment to get them equal protection. That seems pretty intuitive. Yep. And then if you actually ask, well, so what, and this is something Justice Sotomayor points out in her dissent, well, what actually happened after Congress in the 1860s adopted the 14th Amendment? Well, turns out laws passed during Reconstruction literally like identified formerly enslaved Black people for particular benefits. And so there was this sort of historical tradition of using that clause as sort of authorizing particular treatment, which I guess you'd call unequal treatment, to ensure, to kind of fulfill the promise of equal protection. I also, but then going over to sort of Justice Jackson's dissent, she sort of makes this point that, that, you know, to her, there's this willful ignorance thing going on. She has this great passage. She says, with let them eat cake obliviousness today, the majority pulls the ripcord and announces colorblindness for all by legal fiat, but deeming race irrelevant in law does not make it so in life. And she also says, our country has never been colorblind. And I think that's really the essence of the dissent. Yeah. Obviously, yeah. I'm way over summarizing an excellent dissent, but I'll stop there.
Can you talk a little bit about the trial itself? Because you mentioned to us, or at least wrote in the notes, that there were also some concerning aspects of the trial and how it was conducted.
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of zoom into the real nitty gritty and away from the like Supreme Court issues, you know, the way a case gets to the Supreme Court, it's just any other case. You have two sides disagree about something, they go to court, they have a trial, and one side wins, and then the loser appeals, and then the loser appeals again, you end up in the Supreme Court. So this case had a trial, and, you know, as you said, Lyle, at the beginning, Students for Fair Admission is the plaintiff that brought this case. Students for Fair Admission did not put on a single student as a witness in their case. And Harvard put on several. And as happens in a trial, you know, there's a finder of fact that can either be a judge or a jury who decides kind of which side was credible and which side should win, and decided that the experts for Students for Fair Admission were not credible. Why am I telling you all this? It matters because when you go up on appeal, the side that the trial court decided was more credible, the appellate courts are not supposed to just, the appellate court is supposed to give some deference to the court that was there in the room listening to this testimony. The idea is you have a better sense when you're listening to it live, seeing if you cross-examine it, kind of who's credible and who is not. And when this case went to the Supreme Court, each side just cited the expert testimony or witnesses that kind of supported their argument and didn't really bother with saying, well, the district court didn't find this to be a believable expert and didn't really pay any sort of attention or give any deference to the fact that a trial court found Student for Fair Admissions case to be
it didn't suit their needs, so they just decided to ignore.
Yeah, and I think that's like it's like poor. It's just not good. Look, whatever you think of what's motivating the court, like it doesn't make the court look good to sort of not honor those sort of the procedural history of the case.
Yeah, well, I think that's what is going on with so many of these cases. Obviously, I think, you know, people are mad just about the repercussions, but, you know, a lot of people who are really watching these closely in this specific court, I mean, I think are really, you know, looking at, you know, you've seen a lot of people talk over the last year anyway, sort of about the, you know, the legitimacy of the court. And it's things that you're describing right now that make people question that, because, you know,
they stick to these strict originalist arguments and whatnot. And then they also are like overturning legal precedent without acknowledging it. And they're not adhering to sort of like the same judicial process as the court has always and forever adhered to. Like they're originalists only when it's convenient, obviously, because this is all breaking various kinds of precedents that you would think also might matter to you if you cared that much about conserving the original sort of perfect and impossible to, you know, to perfect system that we, you know, that we use for these kinds of judicial cases.
Yeah, I mean, law is a field where the formalisms matter, where we're supposed to think like, you know, and even if you are secretly in your head just motivated by the outcome, you're supposed to go through all the motions because it protects how the court appears to operate. And we talked, you know, last time I was on, we talked about some of the ethics scandals. And there seems to be not only a lack of a concern sometimes for the actual rules, but also a lack of a concern for how the court appears to function. And the appearance of a functioning court is really important to a functioning government.
Oh, yeah, because we even since the last time you were here, there are new ethics scandals, too. We didn't even talk about
it. We didn't have the Alito ones, I don't think. Right. So, when you were here last.
There's just so many opportunities to fly on private jets.
I want those opportunities.
Somehow I have not gotten a single one.
There's not that many, Ben.
Right.
Because... That's true.
So there are also two cases here. There are also two cases here that have... that where there's questions about standing in the first place that have been kind of swirling. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about standing, the legal doctrine, and what it means and why these cases exist despite questions about standing swirling around them.
Sure. So the Constitution creates the idea of federal courts, and it says the courts can decide, quote, cases and controversies. And the Supreme Court has interpreted that language to say, basically, look, a court can get involved and decide an issue when there's an actual case or controversy, meaning there's actually a person who has been like injured by a thing, not physically injured, but just harmed by a thing. And there's another party, the defendant, you know, from whom they can get their relief. And so the like most ordinary case, right, is like, Lila and I made a contract that I'd pay her $1,000 to come paint my house. She doesn't show. I was harmed because my house didn't get painted. I can sue her for breach of contract. That's like
just like
that is for sure what would happen someone tried to pay me $1,000 to paint their home. It would not get painted. That's
an absolute no show.
Yeah. But I mean, also, can they decide any controversy? Like, are there Kardashian controversies that they can also weigh in on according to this language? I feel like the language of controversies is new to me, but sounds exciting.
Yeah, I don't think any controversy quite in that sense. But what it means to say is, if you're just someone who you're upset by something, but you weren't really involved in it or harmed by it, like, you know, I can't go sue because you didn't go paint somebody else's house. It has to be that you're the party. You have an injury in fact. You're the plaintiff with an injury in fact. And so this arises, for example, in the student debt context. You know, you might be annoyed, as we saw on like, you know, Twitter for so long, that like, well, hell, I paid my student debt, and why should these other people have their debt relief? Like, that's not you really being harmed by the policy. That's you disagreeing with it, and that's different. So it's important always to have a plaintiff that has actually been harmed by the thing that they are challenging. Well, that's the basic idea of standing. It can get messy because, you know, for example, you can challenge like environmental laws designed to sort of, you know, limit the amount of pollutants in our atmosphere. Well, who's harmed by that? Is it, you know, it might be companies that have to pollute less that are harmed by it. But what if it's an air quality standard that isn't stringent enough? You could say that every person who breathes is injured by that. So you have these messy questions, but in certain cases, it's pretty obvious kind of who the injured party is and who isn't.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I think specifically in the student loan case, it wasn't a student ultimately here. And some of those cases were attempted to be brought here, and most of them were thrown out. You know, you saw a few, I think, early cases where people, you know, some student or, you know, former, you know, somebody who currently had student loans or had paid theirs or whatever. And none of those are the ones that ultimately made it to the Supreme Court because they were all essentially thrown out.
That's right. There were two student loan cases that made it to the Supreme Court, both challenging the policy. And the one that was thrown out, I think, was people who were challenging it because it did not reach to their loans. And so they were saying, look, my objection to this policy is it doesn't go far enough. And basically, that's not injury. In fact, the court says, because you're the same off, you know, today
just bad
as
luck.
You were yesterday. Right, sure. It's a policy disagreement. Right.
Yeah.
But of course, the one they did let go ahead was the one where the plaintiff was Mohila.
Right. But the
We're
plaintiff
really.
Wasn't the point, but the plaintiff wasn't really Mohila, right? The plaintiff was the state of Missouri sort of on behalf of Mohila. Yes. I mean,
yeah,
I think that's sort of like where we get into the issue. That is the issue of standing here, because it seemed as though Mohila, who just to, you know, put a, you know, to say that's a loan servicer, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, this was a borderline case for sure. I mean, I think a loan servicer makes a little money every time it has to, you know, service a loan transaction. If there are by law fewer loan transactions to service, it will make less money. It's very well recognized, you know, in I would probably say centuries of Supreme Court doctrine, but at least decades, that like even a dollar of harm, if it's sort of directly traceable to the new policy, is enough for standing. But two things. One, the smaller thing, yeah, that's not really like the people directly affected by it. It's a loan servicer. It's not really like the lender, say, or the borrower. It's sort of this middle person. But then the bigger issue was, how much was Mohila really a part of this case? And there are a number of sort of messy cases going back the last few decades saying, you know, well, how do we deal with it when it's a state agency? And how do we deal with it if it's a corporate body created by state law versus and I think Mohila is one of these, it's a corporation created by state law, but it has its own corporate personality. It has its own ability to sue and be sued. So can Missouri really sue and say we're injured because Mohila is injured, even though Mohila has its own independent existence?
Right.
And in this case, the court said yes.
I think the way that they sort of got around that, actually, because it's interesting, because I think this case is Nebraska. But there were multiple states
that brought it, and not all of them ended up withstanding.
I think a lot of state attorney generals brought it. And I think the way that they ended up with Missouri, my understanding anyway, is that because Missouri had at one point loaned Mohila money, or, you know, given it money to start it up, essentially. So they were able to claim that if Mohila was going to make less money, then they were going to be harmed because Mohila was not going to be able to repay the loan that the state of Missouri had given to him.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the interesting things about standing doctrine, because you're right, it was Nebraska et al. You know, it was Nebraska and a bunch of other states. And one of the interesting things about standing doctrine is if one plaintiff has standing, that's enough. Then you can go review the case and you don't have to decide if all the other ones do, because if Missouri or Mohila has standing to challenge the policy, then the court can reach it. You now have an official case, which means they're standing, and then they can decide it, and their decisions, because they're the Supreme Court, apply to everyone. So if you can get that one plaintiff withstanding, it can become a quite potent weapon.
Yeah.
This could have been a case that was all focused on Iowa with just one switch to history. That was one of the states that was in the original six. So just lucky for Brent that he doesn't have to carry that around with him for the rest of his life.
Seemed like the Midwestern states were big mad about
Biden
this.
Biden v. Iowa. So does this mean that this invalidates Biden's ability to use the HEROES Act to provide student debt relief? Does it invalidate his ability to provide student debt relief? Can we do something else? This is really a question for Brent, probably, because he's been listening to like just 1,000 angry progressives on podcasts and in the news. Sorry, Ben, go ahead.
I mean, I'm happy to hear Ben's answer and then give mine, which will be less informed than his, but perhaps angrier.
Brent, I think you're actually going to be more the expert here. I mean, the case itself is just about the HEROES Act, but I think what's important to note about the case, more than just its decision on the HEROES Act, is the way it decides the case. So the court invokes this semi-new rule called the Major Questions Doctrine, which is a new doctrine they use in administrative law. And I need like a little detour to explain this, but basically, like, you know, Congress doesn't really make like all of the laws that govern everyday life. There are too many, you know, Congress can't set all the workplace standards and regulate food safety and regulate air quality. It creates agencies and it says, EPA, you know, make good air quality. And then a bunch of specialists, like scientists, have to go interpret the phrase good air quality and adopt regulations that sort of make things safe. Now you say, how do I know whether this is following the statutory command to be good air quality? The doctrine has always been you give the regulators deference because they are the experts on that field. It has to be that way because a court isn't going to know like how to regulate 27 different fields that are governed by federal law. The Supreme Court has recently said, yeah, that's fine. We'll give it deference when it's sort of humdrum stuff. But when they decide major questions, we're going to give much more scrutiny and require a much stronger showing that the statute says you can do exactly this. Otherwise, we're not going to let you. And they used that here because on the text itself, the argument wasn't that strong. The HEROES Act says that the Secretary of Education can, quote, waive or modify any statutory or regulatory provision that governs student loans. It kind of seems like that says waive or modify. So you can knock it out or change it. I mean, that's what the dissent says. And the court says, sure, but that really refers ordinarily to like record keeping provisions or how to get approvals for like changes to your loans. It doesn't apply to forgiveness. And, you know, you know, you can understand that point, I guess, but it's an emergency provision. So of course it can't foresee every possible situation. Of course, these statutes can't say, well, if there's a pandemic and if we need to, you know, rescue people from economic calamity, instead they're written in general terms to give agencies the power to handle these situations. And the Supreme Court is now developing a doctrine that basically says, if you don't have explicit authorization, it's not gonna work. It will limit the ability of agencies across the board to implement broad emergency powers.
How much more explicit can a doctrine get than what they wrote in the Heroes Act? I mean, we're gonna have to get real explicit in these.
Justice Kagan said in her dissent. It's a good point.
I mean, yeah. It's not even possible. In any case, let's also move on quickly to the other case that also has standing issues. That's 303 Creative LLC versus Alenis.
Yeah.
This is a case that we learned in media is based on a fake circumstance that never occurred in the first place, where a graphic designer claims that a gay couple wanted her to build a wedding website for them. And it turned out that the couple that she mentioned is not gay people and also didn't ask her to build a wedding website. And so in fact, she's never been in danger of having to build a wedding website for gay people, but the Supreme Court protected her right to not. Can you just briefly tell us what this case is? What happened here?
Yeah, and some of that stuff didn't seem to make it into the decision. So I think you'll have to.
That was literally just media gossip. It was not in the decision, though it seems like directly relevant information.
Totally relevant. Look, there are some standing doctrines that say, look, if you are clearly about to be injured by something, you know, you don't have to actually wait for your house to burn down. If it's clear that there's, you know, the government has adopted a policy that says, hey, we're going to be, demolishing this block on Tuesday, you can sue to prevent it. You have standing before it happens. Similarly, I think if a law says, you know, this is going to go into effect and it's going to require the following, you can sue kind of before it happens if you can sort of credibly assert that you're going to be imminently harmed. Clearly here, I think there was an issue with that, but that explains why sometimes before something has even happened, you can sue. But I think it's a big whiff if it turns out that the fear was completely fabricated.
This is one of those cases that is just rude, but I'm not really clear on what the consequences of it will be in real. They, not that they won't be bad, but they just seem like they could be very chaotic, because once we all have the right to just be like, I'm not doing business with people whose lifestyle I don't approve of. Like, I also don't approve of evangelical Christian lifestyles. Well, and that goes beyond their religious beliefs. It goes into just sort of like the heart of their moral compass. So like, can I also stop doing business with anyone that I think is annoying? Like, what does this mean in terms of my own religious beliefs.
I'm seeing a lot of that on Twitter, and I think some of it is in jest, but I have a feeling as time goes on, you will probably start seeing more of that, people testing that actually from the other side. I'm seeing people saying that, you know, their bigots are no longer welcome at their business and various things. And I'm curious how that plays out. I mean, we can't really know, I suppose, if you have an opinion before we lose you, that would be lovely to hear.
Yeah, I mean, look, it definitely opens up the door to there being exceptions to anti-discrimination laws, right? It uses the First Amendment as kind of a weapon in that regard. I mean, and look, you're exactly right to ask, like, where are the lines around this? I think in the abstract, this isn't a super easy case. Clearly, if you like went to a professional speech writer or speech giver and said, I'll pay you, you know, and said, look, you have to take all comers and I'd like you to take this money and go give a speech endorsing a political, you know, a politician you vehemently oppose, they could say, no, you can't make me take that position with my speech. But what the two sides are fighting about here was the majority says, well, that's exactly what's happening. You're making this person take a position kind of in support of, gay marriage.
Right.
And they're saying, no, what you're doing is you're saying you're not selling to me because of who I am, or you're not selling to people because of their identity.
Right.
That is different from taking a message. That's just discriminating on the basis of who is the person coming to shop. Now, I think, you know, yeah, if you expand that out and say, well, where's the line? What other services are going to be considered speech? And how many services will people say, well, this is First Amendment, I have the right to, you know, not sell to people, and where's the line? I mean, that's going to be really hard. And I think it's going to, we're going to see a lot of cases where people are trying to use the First Amendment as a way out of anti-discrimination laws. And I'm not sure that's a good thing.
Also, hasn't this woman ever heard of just politely saying that you're too busy to take them as a client? You can, in your heart, be as hateful as you want, as long as you are just polite to people's faces. A lot of people are being hateful in their hearts. I'm talking a lot about people's hearts today. I don't know.
<I'm> very emotional. Also, we saw her website. I was like, the gays aren't going there. It's a very graphic design is my passion style situation that she's
not
running with.
One here. It's like, danger.
We're not going there. So she was in no danger of being asked by anyone with taste to do a wedding website,
right.
Which is, you know, I guess a separate issue that the court probably didn't weigh in on, but but they should have.
Before you have to go, is there anything that you want to add by way of context, gossip, or interesting facts about any of these cases?
You know, I think you're seeing, as this 6-3 court kind of does more work over more years, you're really seeing some tensions develop in these opinions. There seem to be definitely snipping, and it seems to be more personal than usual in these majority opinions and these dissents.
Drama.
And I think that's something to watch, because you know, the court has a history of being extremely collegial and the disputes aren't personal.
Yeah.
But I think as these decisions get more and more, you know, perceived to be more and more extreme, and maybe they are, you know, let's see if that can hold together. And if the court appears to look more like less of an institution and more of like,
do you think people. To some degree, and then we'll let you go, sorry, even though I just asked you a question a second ago and said, and then I'll let you go. But in some of those dissents, do you think that some of that sniping, obviously, I mean, it may be personal, but do you think some of those are just sort of them saying like, look, here's, obviously they're saying, look, this is what's wrong with these, but like just to the broader public being like, here's why this court is sort of a sham. Like, are they noting that to sort of like us as people watching this to be like, this is, you should be looking out for this court because it's a mess.
Yeah, I don't presume to be able to get in their heads, but I think they're certainly trying to sound an alarm and say this is more than just a usual disagreement. This is really important. I think they're probably also trying to persuade their colleagues over time, but I think that's, you know, obviously really hard. And I think there's the classic sort of dissenting rationale of you're hoping to lay down the importance of it and the reasoning for hopefully that position being the majority one day.
So Ben had to jump. We're going to keep yammering on a little bit, but like, that was really great, because I just feel like you don't even get that, you know, really even on the news in terms of sort of actually getting the ins and outs of some of these things. You hear people ranting and raving, which, you know, I'm about to do, but just in terms of like, you know, someone reasonably explaining to you these, how ridiculous these things are, as opposed to just sort of like, you know, being big mad about them, which I mean,
well,
I think that's why we keep
doing legal
like,
spectaculars too, because he does a really good job of breaking down a lot of these cases while also giving you legal context for them, which I think
for why you should be mad.
Yeah, you're just not
getting if you want to be. Yes,
a lot of the context in a lot of the coverage.
Yeah, totally.
I noted one thing that I thought was really interesting as I was just like sort of looking through stuff for the doc today, is that a lot of news stories about these cases don't tell you the name of the case. So later when they get referenced as precedent for things, you like don't, it's hard to connect what case we're talking about.
Yeah.
So I feel like also that's just, there's like missing context when you talk about Supreme Court cases. And also it's a little bit like the props actually, when you think about it, where knowing the context of previous court cases is really important to understanding what the court's doing now. It's one of the reasons that I think our prop guide is like a really outstanding prop guide, is just because we've been doing it so long that we know which props are end runs around the legislature. We know a lot of stuff based on the experience of having written them for so long.
Yeah. And that's why I think it's so great to be able to have him on, because it's a lot to ask of people to know the things that he just told us. People don't, because they're not lawyers, and people don't because it's not explained to them, and people, you know, there's a myriad of reasons why people don't know. I mean, we don't, and we follow these things, you know.
Exactly.
What I mean, like I have been following the student loan case like fairly closely, but to your point just a second ago, I wasn't even, when I saw that it was Nebraska, I was like, wait a minute, that's not right, it's Missouri, because
right.
I knew that it was the whole, you know, Missouri and Mohila snafu that was able to allow it to be Missouri in the first place, but like, so I was like, wait, Nebraska, what's Nebraska doing here?
Exactly.
And I'm a person who I feel like was paying a reasonable amount of attention about it.
No, I feel like, especially given that the entire news cycle of the last week has been like just fully given over to people panicking about these cases, I still felt like I learned a lot just now about them as someone who has been consuming plenty of media around them, just because a lot of the media is the gossip part that I pay attention to the actual like legal arguments for what's going on.
Yeah.
In any case, and you wanted to talk a little bit more about the student debt case.
Just yeah. I mean, I want to talk about the gossip part of it, which is what you just said. Great setup for me to go on about this. And I'm sure you'll be happy to partake about it. But, you know, we sort of started talking a little bit about it in terms of the HEROES Act. Right. And I think he brought up a lot of good reasons why it seems like maybe the HEROES Act should have worked. Right. But, you know, there were a lot of questions about the use of the HEROES Act by the Biden administration going into this. Anybody who is anybody that has been working on the student loan crisis over the better part of the last decade has been urging the Biden administration to use the Higher Education Act to forgive student loan debt. You'll remember that there were many people saying that you could forgive all student loan debt on day one via executive action long before we had a pandemic.
Right.
I mean, Biden used the HEROES Act and, you know, and COVID-19 is the reason why people shouldn't have to pay back their loans. So there were parts of the left, the more conspiracy leaning parts of the left.
That's who Brent is connected to on Twitter.
That really felt like when Biden released this plan and used the HEROES Act as the reasoning, that felt as though perhaps they may have used that because they knew it wasn't a great legal argument. Now, I don't know. That feels a little dark to me, I guess. Right. But I mean, you know, every student loan debt organization or nonprofit or whatever has written their own version of an executive order that all he needs to do is sign. And all of them are using the Higher Education Act. And it was interesting this week when Biden came out on Friday after this got shot down and said that he was still going to look into relieving student debt, it was because now he's going to use the Higher Education Act to do it.
Right.
So a lot of people, while happy that he has gotten to that point, I think now really have reason to be pissed at him for not doing it in the first place, because that's what everybody was telling him to do in the first place all along. And I think when you sort of like think about his history as someone who obviously had never really had any intention of forgiving student loan debt, if we remember back to his campaign in 2020, as a person who, as the senator from the tax haven of Delaware, was personally responsible for making sure that you couldn't include your student loan payments in your bankruptcy filing.
Right.
It becomes less of a stretch to believe that maybe he intended for this to fail.
There's also a line between like where maybe he just didn't intend for it to succeed. I think that's really more his style here, where like, I have always felt like his rhetoric about student loan, his policy promises on student loan were all just designed to be appeasements and this is a classic like new Democrat move. To be like, I totally get it. You guys want healthcare. We totally know. And then they'll be like, we'll make one not very good faith attempt to get you halfway to having healthcare.
Right.
And it didn't work though. Sorry, bye.
Well, right. And that is exactly why I'm the most upset, because I don't need to wade into whether he wanted it to fail.
No, I mean, but it's not
what
relevant,
I think is important here to your exact point is that this is a man who, let's imagine for a second, he really did believe that this was the best legal argument for him to make. You know, he did send his solicitor general to the Supreme Court to defend it. So let's just imagine for a second that he really did believe that he had the legal authority to forgive student debts. And the choice that he made was to forgive $10,000 of it and still leave over 50% of student debtors with crippling debt. Like that, I think, really sort of like tells you a lot about, like, I think to your point, the party as to where it's at right now, but also like him specifically, like I know something that I could do that would help 40 million people be, as he himself said, start a family, pay their rent, buy a house, do whatever it is that they would do, feed themselves, honestly. I mean, at the point where you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt, you're worried about more than, you know, being able to start a family. And then choosing to just not do that thing. Like, it's so bonkers and bizarre to me that that is what you, that's the choice that you would make. I just, I don't get it. I don't get it.
No, and I don't, I mean, I think that the main thing to get here is that this is not a priority for him, though it is a priority for, I just, the thing that I don't understand, we've known it's not his priority. He doesn't understand the issue. He came of age at a time where this isn't a conversation. There's a lot of people who came of age at different times who just don't actually understand the scale of what young people are facing when it comes to student debt.
100%.
And he, like, even if he can intellectually hear numbers, I intellectually hear numbers all the time about how most people aren't rich and famous, but I still think to myself all the time, why don't I have a townhouse? You know, like, it's not like, this is like the kind of thing where in order to passionately pursue change, you have to have an emotional understanding of how bad it is, not just that it's bad, but how bad it is.
Right.
And he doesn't have that. And so he's never going to have that. I just, the thing that I've never understood about this issue, and I mention it on every podcast, so let's, why not mention it here as well? But like, I don't understand who the constituency is for not doing anything. Like, I don't understand, like, this is an incredibly popular policy. The number of people who are mad about it is shrinking every day.
Yeah.
Because they are dying, because the people who don't understand why this is important are old. And and by the way, not even all old people, because old people have kids. And old people have kids who are in huge amounts of debt. And
old people have student debt.
Have student debt. Exactly. But like, I just like don't understand why there is not someone in his office. Not him. Again, he emotionally cannot understand why this is so bad, but cannot sit him down and be like, I recognize that you don't connect to this issue, but I want to be clear that like we have to do something. Like one of the reasons that that like income inequality is so crazy, that society is like on the brink, that housing prices are nuts, is like we have a debt crisis in this country. You might have heard about debt crises before. And like, though this is not one affecting people of your generation, it's an actual emergency. Like, I just don't understand how, and more importantly than that, because I mean, say all that, but he doesn't care. It's a huge political winner.
And I know.
The bigger the relief, the bigger a win it is too, which is the other thing that I feel like is so frustrating.
I think partly why Democrats, a lot of times, what they get wrong about so many policies is that I think that he thought maybe people would be less mad, or less people would be mad, and there would be less political blowback by having the number be lower. And what I don't, and that's just not accurate, because
it's
the people who were going to be mad, the people who were going to be mad about debt forgiveness were going to be mad whether it was $1, or they were going to be mad if he just literally wiped clean everyone's debt slate, right? Like, so this idea that some sort of half measure would allow him to be able to have it both ways, where he would appease student debtors and then also have Republicans not mad at him, is not, that space doesn't exist. That space of having it both ways doesn't exist, because what you've done is the people who were going to be mad about it are still mad about it, and are mad about it all the way enough to take it to the fucking Supreme Court. And the people who you were supposed to help are still mad about it because you didn't help them enough to get them out of crippling debt. So really what you've done is like mostly nothing, and gotten yourself into some weird quagmire by using the wrong law. I mean, with all due respect. Yeah.
Who are you worried is going to take offense to that?
No, I'm not.
It just got shot down in the Supreme Court.
I mean, I'm losing respect for him on the by
Brent
the hour.
Is worried about his due respect today for some reason.
So
it's America's birthday.
It just doesn't make any sense. And this is a note for him, and it's also a note for Democrats as they sort of think about literally all policy. Right? It's if we're not thinking about it in the way that helps the maximum amount of people in the maximum amount of ways, then you're fucking doing it wrong.
That's, I think, really, when we get down to it, the basis of why there's so much apathy about them in the first place. And the basis 100%. Of the New Democrats, I keep talking about the New Democrats. I realize that's a dated reference that no one talks about anymore. Fine, it's a Clinton era reference, but it's had such an, I mean, we're still dealing with New Democrat era.
New Democrats,
people.
So, DLC.
Like the president is still, like a million years old. He's still part of that movement. This is the repercussions of it. Yeah. And this is more importantly, the strategy that they laid out for how to be Democrats, right. Which is just, you pursue the least, you know, you pursue incremental change that yeah. can always be peeled back, that doesn't challenge any moneyed interests, right. that doesn't actually help anyone. And then because the, you know, the alternative is like literal mayhem, you kind of make it seem like the sort of change that America, that the way that America changes is slow and steady. And so we don't need to do anything. And the thing is, that might be true in an era where everything's going swimmingly and, you know, there's not any major crises on the horizon. And I can't think of when that era in America has ever been, but that could, you know, that could be true. It's how people think about the 90s, even though the 90s were a fucking mess, but like, it's how people think about the 90s.
It is.
We are not in that kind of an era right now. We are literally like in the middle of 17 different crises, but more than that, we're in the middle of an economic crisis that is so severe that we now take it. We're in the middle of like a surf uprising, basically. Like the income inequality conversation, which because it happened incrementally, no one talks about, is so much more extreme and more on people's minds than I think the political class realizes. And so like right now we actually do require like emergency, extraordinary, you know, interventions in order to deal with it. The way in which regular people are being asked to finance their lives is not sustainable in any way. Our quality of life sucks because of it. And it's not that our quality of life sucks because, you know, we had a pandemic or, I mean, it wasn't great to have the pandemic, but I mean, like, it's not that our quality of life sucks because of that. It doesn't even just suck because of gun violence, even though it also sucks because of that. Like, there are so many financial reasons that our lives just like totally fucking blow in this country. Yeah. And those are things that the government is, I think, charged with and responsible for fixing quickly. You can't rely on incrementalism to undo Jeff Bezos levels of wealth. You just have to fucking take it from him. And like, these are all policies that in the 90s, no one would have dared even suggest that are widely popular now. Like, I bet if you polled the American public, people would just be willing to I'm not using the term rob, he doesn't deserve that wealth, but like to just strip him of that wealth, we're in an eat the rich moment.
Yeah.
And to not understand that the crisis is that severe and to be trying incrementalism in a moment like this, where everything that we know is destabilized and nothing, you know, we have no sort of like promise or hope. Like most people our age will never own homes. We will not have retirements. Like all, you know, to not recognize that requires like at least a little vision politically, not even like I said, emotionally, he's never going to get it. And I don't fucking care if he does, but like politically is so wild. They're bad politicians.
I know.
And this has been
he's slapping his name on this, by the way. Years. But yes. that's Bidenomics. That's what he's running on in 2024.
It's so embarrassing. It's embarrassing. That's all. That's what it is. I don't even know what else.
I agree.
I agree that this smacks of, it's not even just like a lack of vision. It's like bad politics and they don't understand why.
Yeah.
And now we're going to have to be in an election season with them.
You know, it's been a while since we talked about this, but we used to talk a lot about sort of like, you know, sometimes bad politics is good policy, sometimes good policy, you know, sometimes, you know, but like, this is like bad both, right? Because it like both didn't help as many people as it should have, considering what it is that people are going through. And it was also just like bad politics in the sense that it's just like, it didn't do anything for anyone to like think better of you in the end, you know what
no.
I mean? It's like, it was just, you can't do things that are both bad politics and bad policy. You got to pick, one of them has to be something good.
One of them has to be something good. And they are picking losers on all counts.
That's right.
In any case, I feel like this could
have. Happy 4th of July.
I feel like this could have been the impetus for them to go like balls to the wall.
Well, that's what I was like. I was saying when he said immediately that he was coming out after those cases on Friday, I was like, ooh, we're getting dark Brandon, guys, right? And then we didn't get dark Brandon. We got funny enough, we did get dark Brandon during that press conference, but it was as he was walking away when somebody asked him about Afghanistan. That's when we got dark Brandon. He ran back faster than he's moved in the last, you know, decade, probably, to scream at the reporter who asked him about Afghanistan after he was supposed to be complaining about, you know, the last, you know, the Supreme Court, which I found telling and not surprising, certainly, that that would be what he seemed to be most worked up about. But I was like, the right answer for him to do during that press conference was to come out with a fucking pen and an executive order, you know, yeah, with a rule to just wipe it clean immediately. You don't have debts any longer, yeah, based on the Higher Education Act. And that's not to say it wouldn't have gone back to the Supreme Court, because probably would have.
Buy people some time.
Yeah. Well, and that was another thing that people were complaining about too, was that it was means tested, not just because like means testing is bad, a bad idea for all of the reasons that means testing is
right,
a bad idea.
Right, we talk about means testing being done all the time. But
by making people apply for it and then making those applications be approved, like it was those things that gave this time to work itself through the courts before the debt was actually forgiven. Because I think a lot of people have made the point, rightly, I think, like once that debt is gone from people's accounts,
right,
it's going to be very hard, even if the Supreme Court says that it has
to be paid.
Are they
going to have them pay it back?
For those,
like, to who?
For that to all of a sudden now be something that people have to pay when, you know, it doesn't exist any longer. Because this is, you know, we should remind people, even though we've done it a million times, this is federally held debt, not to oversimplify it, but like, this is like me going out, you and I going out for lunch and me paying for it, and then me telling you that you don't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing here.
It's also like, it's a public good to educate people, which is why we do it for free at every level except college. So the fact that this is public money that is being used to finance a thing that we already know is a public good because we do it at every other level is like, there's an easy public argument to make there.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, why did you enjoy going to kindergarten for free? Great.
Yeah. Well, like, and that I think is another reason why some of the, you know, conspiracy left thinks that he maybe intended for this to fail, because there's a secondary problem here. And the that problem is that while obviously we should forgive crushing debt that people have of hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, it doesn't solve the problem for, there are people in college right now who have taken out loans for hundreds of thousands of dollars. There are people who are, you know, 10 years old now, in 8 years will take out those same loans if we don't do something about free college. And if there's one thing that he has no interest in doing, it's talking about free college.
No, I know, which is wild, because that was like a Jill Biden special.
Right. I wonder if he's still sleeping. Remember when he was supposed to be sleeping on the couch, because like she was making him sleep on the couch if he pulled out, you know, 2-year college free sleeping on the couch, or do we think that the Bidens have forgot about that and he's back in bed? My guess is that they've forgotten about it and he's back in the bed.
That is also my guess. Well, and you know that I have a long history of complaining about the way that Democrats who are centrist Democrats frame college as if it's some sort of distinct thing from public education more broadly. I mean, this is why I'm constantly taking Pete Buttigieg to task, is because he wanted, even though he was talking about free college, but he wanted to means test it because he didn't, quote unquote, want to educate, you know, pay to educate the children of billionaires. And I was like, there's a reason that we agree to do that in elementary school, though, because billionaires are welcome to go to public school for their entire education up till 12th grade. And
I think that's great. I was going to say, I would like the children of billionaires to end up being smarter than their parents.
That's right. But I would also like them to have an investment in public goods,
of course,
which is something that you can only have if you have benefited from public goods. So the fact that they are paying ostensibly, hopefully, if we had this right, higher taxes would offset the cost of us educating them for free. There is no world in which we ever have to educate the children of billionaires for free. we just have to think about where the money's coming from and how we're getting it and what circumstances it's being collected under. Like the, but, yeah. but that argument to me devalues our commitment to public education broadly, because it claims that there are classes of people that are entitled to free education and not. And I recognize that the reason he gets away with that talking point is because the class of people we're talking about is billionaires. But I actually do think that, you know, if billionaires can be barred for free education, I don't see why people who don't pay taxes can't be barred. And once people who don't pay taxes can be barred from public education, then the very people who need public education are being barred from public education. And that's a very short leap. So yeah. I feel like in my own legal argument, the Democrats have been engaged in the act of devaluing both just like the concept of public goods and specifically public education in rhetoric that is meant to demonize the rich for years now. And Joe Biden is a part of, and Hillary Clinton, by the way, is also a part of that movement. I mean, that's there. I'm struggling to think of one really high profile national politician who's not besides someone in like the Sanders movement. You know, the Sanders right. camp people are not, but like, it's a challenge to figure out who that person is. And just like, this is the inevitable result of not having a strong public value in public goods is like a case like this, where we're trying to undo damage that we've already done and we're barely achieving that, goes to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, because they've also stolen the court, is, you know, being run by people who have no empathy for anyone. And now we just accept that we live in a society where we don't value a public good that benefits everyone.
Wait, right. Wait. Yeah.
Crazy. I can always bring it back to Pete Buttigieg and why I'm mad at him. So I think that's important to remember if you want to come at me with points about anything.
Yeah.
In any case, we'll next week get into we'll get back to the presidential race. We'll get back to the excitement and thrills of regular political life. But happy 4th, everybody.
Mm-hmm. America.
Enjoy the sounds of war as they echo through your windows all night.
Oh, yeah. Your favorite. It's your favorite holiday.
My favorite holiday. Just nothing that a little Xanax can't.
Ooh.
I mean,
are we sharing?
I feel like they should give Xanax out for free to everyone for the 4th of July because it's so terrifying on the streets.
Yeah.
Just like being in the middle of a war zone for a night. And then we're like happy about it for some reason. Yeah. We like have barbecues to celebrate war.
Well, I'll tell you what we're not going to be doing in America anytime soon is giving free medicine to anybody. So
that's such a good point.
That won't be happening. You're going to have to continue to buy that Xanax for yourself right. and whoever you would like to share it with.
Exactly. In any case, we'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.